Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 96, Modern Tribe. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we're here continuing our series looking at what we call regular Jews, that is, people who are not Jewish professionals, who didn't train to be Jewish professionals, who didn't set out to be Jewish professionals, who are inspired, who become unbound, and who go on to create something really exciting. And so today we are going to be looking at Modern Tribe, which is an online gift shop that carries all kinds of interesting Jewish products that connect Judaism and the times in which we live. Our guests today are Jenny Rivlin Roberts and Amy Kreitzer. Jenny is the founder of Modern Tribe and the original owner, and Amy Kreitzer is the current owner of Modern Tribe. Before we get started with this interview, we just want to say, because it's December and it's the time of year that people think about their charitable giving, that we really hope that you'll recognize Judaism Unbound in your charitable giving plans. We are part of the Institute for the Next Jewish Future, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So any gifts you make to Judaism Unbound are tax deductible. You can go to our website at www.judaismunbound.com/donate to make a donation. You can make a one-time donation or a recurring monthly donation. We love and need gifts of any size, ranging from $18 to $18,000. One thing that we suggest for folks who are not mega donors is that you might consider a gift of about a dollar for every episode of Judaism Unbound that you've listened to and enjoyed this year. So if you've listened to every one, you know, maybe it'll be in the realm of $50 or so. And if you've only listened to one or two, then maybe you could bump it up to $18. And I also want to announce that there is a special holiday coupon that we're making available to our listeners at Modern Tribe. So if you order something from Modern Tribe, you can put in Hanukkah 2017, that's H-A-N-U-K-K-A-H 2017, and you'll get 10% off your order. So if you get 10% off your order at Modern Tribe, feel free to make the balance of that contribution to Judaism Unbound. We'd be really grateful. So now let's get into our conversation with Jenny Rivlin Roberts and Amy Kreitzer. Let me just give a few more words of introduction. Jenny Rivlin Roberts is the founder of Modern Tribe. She's a native of Atlanta, Georgia. She's got a PhD in industrial and organizational psychology from Georgia Tech. She's worked in a number of Fortune 500 companies and also founded an incubator and accelerator for Jewish social entrepreneurs in Atlanta called Protege. That's P-R-O-T-E-J. And our second guest, Amy Kreitzer, in addition to being the current owner of Modern Tribe, is also a well-known Jewish food blogger and cookbook writer. She blogs at whatjewwantoeat.com. You'll have to go to the show notes to look for the exact spelling of that. And her cookbook, which came out about a year ago, I think, is called Sweet Noshings. You can find links to all of this stuff in the show notes for today's episode. And we are really excited to welcome Jenny Rivlin Roberts and Amy Kreitzer to Judaism Unbound.
Yes, it's so nice to be here after being with you and Lex at Le Mood Atlanta.
Great. So, so we're talking here about a set of stories of folks that didn't set out to be Jewish professionals and somehow got into the Jewish business one way or the other. And there's lots more to discuss with Modern Tribe, with your blog, Amy, What You Want to Eat, and with your cookbook and all sorts of things. So we've got a lot to talk about here. But I wanted to jump in, Jenny, first with talking about the origins of Modern Tribe. But maybe first we should just describe for listeners who don't know, what is Modern Tribe?
Sure. Modern Tribe is a website at moderntribe.com that is a gift shop with modern design, Judaica, and Jewish gifts that are fun and fit a younger Jewish audience.
And from what I could tell from your bio, it wasn't your childhood dream to build an online Jewish gift shop.
No, not at all. In fact, I spent 8 years going and getting a master's and a PhD in industrial and organizational psychology. And then after having my child and thinking about going back to work, I had always been entrepreneurial. And my husband and I had created the game, which I consider the flagship product from Modern Tribe. The game is called No Limit Texas Dreidel, which is a cross between traditional dreidel and Texas Hold'em poker. And it was really the advent of that game that my husband and I created to play with our friends that first gave me the idea that there might be an opportunity for creating an updated consumer product / retail experience for the younger Jewish generation.
I'm 99% sure that I own that. The Texas dreidel. I believe I have that in my childhood home in Milwaukee and received it for Hanukkah. So I did not realize that was Modern Tribe. Cool.
Yeah. So it really was through the advent of the game and the fact that I've always had business ideas. I've tried different things throughout my life. This was the first real commitment that I made to starting a business. And as you can see, it worked. That was back in 2007. And so we started really with the game and a few other products, selling them on Modern Tribe and using the game to launch the larger online business.
And how did you go about that? Like, how did it go from game to business? Like, I guess this is a question just in general for entrepreneurial ideas, but specifically for Modern Tribe, what was the process?
I knew that we had a good idea with the game because I had, like, years ahead of time, had been playing it with my friends at our adult Hanukkah parties, and everybody had fun and enjoyed ourselves playing dreidel, which is something that adults don't do with regular dreidel. So I knew that I had something with the game. I had friends saying, why aren't you creating this and selling it? You know, for a couple of years, I was like, I don't know. And then eventually I was thinking, yeah, maybe we could make this work. I brought it to some festivals just in prototype form and saw that the kids, especially boys ages like 10 to 14, went crazy over it. Again, it's sophisticated enough for adults to play to where no adult would normally play dreidel. And then I was thinking, well, if there's an opportunity with this game, maybe there's an opportunity for more Jewish retail. When I went online to see where I could possibly sell No Limit Texas Dreidel online, and of course in the local gift shops, I noticed once again, or I was reminded once again, that the retail space for Judaica wasn't really up to par with what you'd expect in other retail. So I thought, I bet there's an opportunity to do something even bigger than just the game. And then I had the idea that I would use the publicity from the game to start the bigger business. And so for the first year in 2007, all of my marketing efforts were focused on No Limit Texas Dreidel and having it exclusive to moderntribe.com. And we ended up getting a lot of press both in the Jewish newspapers and then also in national newspapers. That first year, we were in the Chicago Tribune. And honestly, back then, I didn't even realize how hard it is to actually have that happen. But we were just really lucky. I mean, it was an idea that was very catchy, especially at the time. Poker was really hot. The hotness of poker kind of ebbs and flows. Yep. It was like peak poker at that time, and people were watching poker on ESPN, and so it just really was a good product for the time. And we were able to use the traffic and the customer set that the sale of the game generated to grow the business into a larger online retail store.
And then, so it's funny because as I'm listening to you know, the beginning of that story about when you went around to the gift shops, you know, I think about how many times I've gone into synagogue gift shops with the express intent of buying something, you know, that I really was looking for something to buy for my kids for Hanukkah or whatever. And, you know, probably 99 times out of 100, I've walked out just not finding a single thing to buy and just wondering, you know, what's going on there? And, you know, then I poke around Modern Tribe and I'm like, you know, finding a lot of things that I would want to buy. So what was your, I guess, what's your analysis of that? Why are these gift shops sort of not carrying the stuff that I would want to buy? And how did you go about building the product line for Modern Tribe?
I think Amy probably now understands that it's really it's an exercise in curation, and it's an exercise in being really discriminating on which products to add to the catalog. Because there are lots and lots of choices out there. It's just that a lot of things don't necessarily fit the feel or the core market, I guess you'd say, for Modern Tribe. And I think the curation is what makes the shopping experience fun and exciting and engaging. And it's also paring down and not having too many choices too. It's certainly an art to find the right collection of products.
I'm going to nerd out for a second because you mentioned that in the early 2000s, poker went through a huge revolution in certain senses. And like so you mentioned like 10 to 14 year olds. I am of the generation of the age where, so I watched Chris Moneymaker. His name was literally Moneymaker.
Yes, I remember.
When the 2003 World Series of Poker, and for those who don't follow this, and that's probably most of you, because like, why? But for those who don't follow the World Series of Poker, Chris Moneymaker in 2003 became the first person to win the World Series of Poker main event, the biggest event in poker, after qualifying in an online tournament. So he was just a random guy. He had played a little bit professionally, I think, but he was not one of these tested veterans. And for years and years, the entire history of the World Series of Poker, it was the same general crew of folks who were winning. And part of that was that it was a relatively small event. I believe in 2003, there were like 700 or 800 people total in the event. And it was by far the biggest at that point. And then you've got this guy, Chris Moneymaker, win. And the equivalent of if like I could go out on the football field on Sunday and play for the Packers, my favorite NFL team, and like win. That's the effect Chris Moneymaker had. And he got all of these people excited about poker because all of a sudden it was a real possibility that just average Joe people who, you know, whatever their day job is, they're also, you know, play poker and they can go and win the biggest event on the planet. And I bring that up because you talked about mapping that, taking that interest and channeling it into something Jewish. And I think there's often huge resistance to that. Like when something is really popular and really exciting in mainstream culture, like there's some instinct deep within us as Jews to be like, that should be separate from the Jewish, like the fun stuff, the mainstream, the cultural, whatever, that should be like separate, far away, because it's somehow inherently like less holy. I'm not here to claim that poker is deeply holy. That's not my goal, but just as an example, I think that you managed to take this incredible interest that was reaching millions of people and find a way to Jewify it in one way or another. And I think that that's really interesting. And I guess I'm curious to hear, have you followed that with any of your other products in the years intervening? And have you gotten any pushback from people within Jewish life about doing
that? Sure. Yeah, absolutely to the pushback question and absolutely to other products for sure. I'll give you some examples. When we first launched No Limit Texas Dreidel and Modern Tribe, we went to the URJ Biennial Conference, and we were set up there with our games, and we had the game out for people to play and buy. And we definitely had people walking by, and this was at a Reform conference, saying, "You are making Hanukkah, the dreidel game, into gambling." And they were critical of it. And my husband and I were together, and we left because, of course, dreidel is a gambling game. It's just that obviously we're making that even more explicit with the fact that we were marrying dreidel with with poker. And I just got used to checking in with myself. And, you know, if I was okay with it, then I was going to be okay with accepting the criticism and telling people, thank you for your criticism. I hear what you're saying. This is why we've decided to do it this way. If it's not for you, that's okay. And then the other question you had was, Lex, was over the years, did we adopt other concepts, other secular concepts into the products that we produce? And I have to say absolutely yes. I mean, the second most successful line of products that we had over the years was the Thanksgivica line, which is obviously a mashup of the Thanksgiving holiday with Hanukkah. That was a huge deal in our country. I think it even went international, where we were able to sell a line of products that was Thanksgiving themed, and along with Modern Tribes products, along with the Minerki, if anybody remembers the Minerki, which happened to created by a little boy in New York. So even better, because what a great story that is. It made it a thing. And then all of a sudden, Thanksgivica was a thing. There were songs, there were recipes. Amy, I know you came up with recipes for Thanksgivica.
Oh, yeah, I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there you go. That's another mashup. One of the last products that I created when I was the owner of Modern Tribe was the metallic tattoos that were really hot just a few years ago. Everybody was wearing these temporary tattoos that were metallic, and they're beautiful. They're like jewelry. And I translated that into Judaic tattoos using a bunch of different graphic designs that we created over the years. And so you're really trying to capture the attention of people who feel an affinity for Judaism, and they love that they are Jews. That's what the Pew study showed. And so when you have something that captures that's secularized, and it can help capture their attention.
Yeah, to go along with what Jenny was saying, I think I continue to do that, to seek out products that are already trendy in the secular world that have a Jewish version. This year for Hanukkah, probably our most popular item so far is a dreidel fidget spinner. If you're familiar with those, I just keep ordering more and more and more, can't keep them in stock. Similarly, we have an emoji menorah that, you know, people already love emojis. There's an emoji movie out, so why not have a menorah that goes along with it? So I think those products are actually the most successful. And then I think it makes it kind of a conversation starter too. Like I have a lot of friends who aren't Jewish, and I showed them the dreidel fidget spinner, and they're like, oh, that's cool. Like, how do you play the dreidel? They want to know more about it. So I think it becomes something that makes it more, you know, comfortable to talk about your Judaism with people that don't know as much about it.
Yeah, and what's funny about the dreidel as a specific example, we've talked about this very briefly at some point on the show, I think. But dreidel itself started, like, people think of it as, oh, that's the authentic Jewish thing, and then you're like putting that on Texas Hold'em. Like, initially, dreidel was based on a bunch of games that people played in bars in pubs in Ireland and in Germany. Like, there you can find these little tops that had symbols on them that were basically the same game as dreidel. And then, like, some Jews I don't know, 1500s, 1600s, I'll find the article somewhere around there, they were like, oh, we should do that Jewish. And they, like, put some Jewish letters on them. And then, you know, 100 years pass, and eventually people decide, oh, yeah, those letters stand for, like, a great miracle happened there. Like, that's not what it meant at first. It was just, like, we're playing a fun game. It can gain deep Jewish content over the years, even if at first it just starts as sort of a fun thing that you're taking from other elements of culture and applying to Judaism. So I just love hearing about how you've done that.
Thank you. And I completely agree. I think that it's the way to go. And I don't think there's anything wrong with piggybacking on what's popular in the secular world in order to bring in Jewish interest. That then helps Jews share their Jewish identity with others.
Yeah, so I want to come back to this topic and another related topics and do a deep dive into this later in the show. I feel like this is sort of like, I guess it was Sleepless in Seattle, where Spoiler alert, but Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan's story are each told sort of separately, and then they end up meeting up together at the end. And, you know, the Empire State Building, or maybe that's a different Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan movie. But anyway, I wanted to go to Amy, to your origin story, because I think you also, from what I've gleaned, didn't set out to become a Jewish professional of any kind, and also started down a different path. And I'd love to know how you got to this Empire State Building here.
Yeah, I definitely did not start. I grew up, you know, Reform. I went to Jewish summer camp, but I was definitely a cultural bagel on Sundays kind of Jew. And after college, I moved to New York City and worked in the business world. I was producing conferences, traveling around the world, having a great time. When 2009 rolled around and the economy crashed and people weren't paying to travel to Miami to learn how to market anymore, I realized I was ready for a change in my career. And I moved from New York City to Austin, just kind of wanted a fresh start, a new city. And I loved Austin so much. And I was working at a consultancy at the time. It just felt like I wasn't creatively challenged like I was in my last job. And I was looking for some kind of outlet. And I started reading food blogs just for fun. And eventually I decided I should start my own blog, since I was reading these all the time. And I'd always really been into cooking and baking, but never thought of it as a career. I just assumed I'd work in some corporate business job. So initially at the time, I was really into baking for different theme parties. So I'd have like a 90s party and make a bunch of yin yang cupcakes for all my friends. And I love doing that. So I said, I'm going to do a baking blog, and I'll do a new cupcake recipe every week. It'll be great. And I told my brother this idea, and usually he goes along with my weird ideas, but instead he said, that's a dumb idea. Like there's a bunch of baking blogs out there already. Like, I think you should do something a little more meaningful. What if you did Jewish food? And I said, I guess, I don't know. That just, like, to me, that just seemed like normal food. Like, I just grew up eating it, so it didn't seem that unique to me. And then he goes, ask your friends in Texas if they know what a knish is. So I said, okay. So I turn around to my office desk and I ask, and no one knows what a knish is. So I think he's onto something. And it was around Hanukkah time in 2010. So I made some potato latkes, but I decided I wanted to put my own little twist on things. So I made them sweet potato, and I made a cranberry applesauce to go with it, kind of maybe an early Thanksgiving recipe there. And I put it on the blog, and I just started blogging every week, and I loved doing it. It was what I was looking forward to, but I didn't know if anyone was reading it besides my mom. I knew she was reading it. After a few months of blogging, I got an email from a reader, and I had never gotten any emails from any readers. I mostly got spam trying to sell me prescription drugs and stuff. And it was this woman in Chicago who was in her early 20s and had grown up, you know, her mother was Jewish, but had passed away when she was young. So she didn't really have this Jewish identity. And now she was kind of learning more about where she came from and decided to learn about some of the recipes and found my blog and had made every recipe I had made so far. And that was kind of an aha moment where I realized, you know, this is more than just food. This is a real connection. This girl is feeling a connection to her history because of this food. And someone who previously didn't know anything about Judaism is interested in it because of my recipes. And because I make them a little unique and modern and fun and approachable. So that was it for me. And I decided I wanted to cook full time. And I quit my job a few months later to go to culinary school. But while I was in school, I entered my blog in a small business contest, and it was a nationwide contest, and I was one of the finalists. And all of a sudden, people started asking me if they could share a recipe in their magazine or their newspaper, and in exchange, they'd promote the contest. So by the time the contest was done, even though I didn't win, all of a sudden, I was a freelance writer, and I was writing for all these magazines, and I had this new career that I didn't even realize I was even an option. And eventually I came out with my cookbook. It came out a year ago, Sweet Noshings, and we saw that on Modern Tribe too. And so I got to go on a tour, and then, you know, around the same time as my book was coming out, I had the opportunity to purchase Modern Tribe. And I had known Jenny and Modern Tribe for years just through Jewish stuff, and I had promoted their products on my blog, What You Want to Eat. And It just seemed like the perfect next step to connect these recipes that were cool and modern and had a unique approach with these products that were similar. So I think it seemed like there'd be a similar audience and a similar connection, and just seemed like something I wanted to be a part of.
Yeah, I have a question. So I'm on the Modern Tribe website right now, and I'm looking around, and there's a bunch of things that really intrigue me that I think are implied by certain elements of the structure. So when I look at, there's a section called Shop by Holiday, and the sections there are Rosh Hashanah, Hanukkah, Passover, and Shabbat. And then there's a More Holidays tab, and it's Purim, Sukkot, Tu B'Av, Yom HaTzma'ut, all in the More Holidays. And I think that this, like, I'm mentioning this not because I want to, like, list off every page of your website for our listeners to eagerly hear about, but because we've talked about on the show how we believe that there's, like, a big three set of modern Jewish holidays, of contemporary Jewish holidays. And we've talked about how they're the high holidays of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, sort of as one package, then Hanukkah and Passover. And that aligns exactly with what you're saying, but what the site is saying with these sections. But I'm curious, so in the More Holidays tab, one thing I think would be incredibly cool is if somebody like Modern Tribe, or somebody listening who wants to emulate Modern Tribe, said, so we understand that the market for other holidays is going to be way smaller, but we believe that there should be some cool, thoughtful, meaningful, interesting, fun products out there for people to enhance other holidays. And more than that, because there's so little out there for them, we're going to, like, set the tone of what they are in the first place. And nobody's going to have any baggage of, like, oh, this is a real menorah, and then this, like, fun one is actually just, like, sort of an imitation. And I guess I'm curious, like, what have you sold for these other holidays? And, like, if you were imagining a hypothetical listener who wants to think about what they could create for other holidays that aren't quite as big a deal in Jewish life, but maybe could be with the right packaging, what would you encourage them to think about as they go about creating such ideas?
Yeah, I mean, something we try to do with these holidays that aren't quite as popular in terms of purchasing is create, we do definitely do that, try to create products that we think people will want to buy. I think something, I was talking to my friend who's Israeli, and she said, she's pretty secular, but says Sukkot is huge. Like, everyone builds a sukkah, everyone decorates it. And in the United States, people, you know, maybe they'll go to one at their synagogue, but it doesn't, most secular Jews don't make a sukkah. So they're not buying the decor, which we do offer, to decorate it. But I'd love to make it a holiday that people celebrated just as much as Rosh Hashanah or Hanukkah. So I think that's something we're trying to do by offering recipes, explaining what Sukkot is for people that don't know, explaining how you can celebrate it, easy ways to celebrate it. Same with Purim. Like, I love Purim. It's just carnivals, and you're dressing up and hamantashen. Like, why isn't that the biggest Jewish holiday? It's so fun, right? So, you know, kind of offering some masks and, you know, different gift baskets that people can give as gifts for Purim. So, in explaining how you celebrate. So I think it's kind of an educational, part offering the right products. But it's, you know, people already buy stuff for Hanukkah. So we'd be foolish not to focus on that and keep creating products for Hanukkah versus Purim, which it's a little harder to get them to even want to buy, opt in, even if it's something really cool.
Yeah, I'm on the website too right now, and I am drawn to the Chrismica section.
Speaking of pushback, we've gotten some pushback on that for sure.
Yeah, I'm really curious about it because, first of all, I have to tell you, like, the first thing that caught my eye, and this was when I was just in the new for Hanukkah section, was the Judolf ornament, which, to describe to our listeners, it's basically a reindeer with the antlers being a menorah, and he's wearing, it appears to me, a tallis. You know, it's a tree ornament. And then I noticed that there's a whole Chrismica section, and I, you know, with all kinds of interesting products like the yarmulkes and a variety of ornaments, an ugly sweater that has both Christmas and Hanukkah on it. And I'm just curious, two things. One, do these products sell a lot? Like, do you find a lot of interest in this fusion? And second, I guess it's a question of, like, how do you think about the push and pull, or the, you know, like, Is it that people have a demand for this kind of stuff, and then you find the best stuff that meets that demand that fits your aesthetic? Or is it more that you find all this stuff that meets your aesthetic that's really cool and you put it up and you see how it goes? Or like, how do you really kind of like test the market to see if there really is a market for this or that, whether it's this, in this case, it's Chrismica, and in the case that Lex was just talking about, it's, you know, trying to put out stuff for some less observed type of holiday that maybe could get a second wind?
So last year, Hanukkah started on Christmas and ended on New Year's. Mm-hmm. And Jenny and I were working together at that point and came up with our Mary G. or Zivica celebration. And we had a whole section for Mary G. or Zivica last year where it really made sense to have these Hanukkah Christmas items since for the first time in a long time, they're on the same day. And they were very popular last year. The Judolf koozie that we had too, which is a Rudolf menorah koozie that you can put over a drink or a bottle of wine, was in Food Network magazine. We sold a ton of those. So I definitely noticed it was popular last year. And even though this year Hanukkah is not on Christmas, people are still wanting these combo items. I think a lot of people are intermarrying, and we can either ignore it and hope it goes away, or we can, you know, embrace it and see people are still part of their Judaism, even if they're married to someone who's not Jewish, and they're going to celebrate Hanukkah and they're going to celebrate Christmas. So we either pretend it doesn't happen and hope they still want to be Jewish, or we can give them some cool stuff.
So when I first started Modern Tribe, this is back in 2007, I did not have Chrismica. I felt that personally, it wasn't a great idea to mix Christmas with Hanukkah. That was personal for me. But then over the years, I just found that it became more and more accepted and more okay. And there was more and more questions and demand for it from our customers. And it does escalate when Christmas and Hanukkah overlaps. And sometimes it overlaps and sometimes it doesn't.
Although I'll say I was pushing the idea last year that we should reschedule Hanukkah so that it always overlaps with Christmas,
because I thought it really
was great. Like, you know, it for all sorts of reasons, not from the mundane that it accords with the kids' vacations to the more profound that it actually fits with families that are celebrating both. So I don't know. Yeah. I didn't get a lot of traction on that one.
Yeah, I don't know. But I'm with Amy in that, you know, our society has gotten to the point where we know that there's a huge percentage of intermarried folks today. I like to think, and I know that a lot of them aren't necessarily teaching their kids traditional Christianity, but a lot of them are celebrating Christmas as a secular holiday. Again, it was something that I really had a transformation with over time and over experience with families, with my cousins who are adults and marrying non-Jews. Some of them have Christmas trees, and really getting to know families that do that and realizing that they still have a Jewish identity. They also celebrate a secular Christmas.
Apparently today I'm like flashing back to all of my memories from like 2003 or like the early 2000s, because I've got another flashback. But I'm just thinking, in terms of Chrismica, you both talked about how there's been a transition over the last couple decades. And I want to reflect that in 2003, the OC did an episode of their show where they like held a Chrismica thing. And I think people had informally been using the term Chrismica before that. But that was, as far as I know, the first like really mainstream big ticket use of Chrismica. And all of a sudden, over the next, I guess at this point, 10-15 years, it seems like there's been all sorts of projects, both ritualized projects of people blending events and consumer products also. And I'm curious, like, have you consciously looked to create any sort of like Jewish changes? Like, have you consciously thought with any products, like, you know what, we're going to put this out there and it's going to be part of shifting X element of Jewish life to be more accepting or more forward thinking or whatever it might be. And as much as, you know, we're going to benefit from it and our business is going to make some money, it's also going to have this other role. Like, has that been part? Because I could see like all sorts of opportunities to maybe make that happen in the future.
One of the things that I always worked towards, and not sure how successful Modern Tribe was doing this, was trying to reintroduce the idea of giving Judaica for bar and bat mitzvahs, because people have gotten away from that. People generally give secular gifts, gift cards, sports stuff, you know, video games. So building out those sections for bar and bat mitzvah was always a goal to try to inspire people to actually give Judaica or something Jewish for those gifting opportunities.
I think for bat mitzvahs, we definitely sell a lot of jewelry for bat mitzvahs. For boys, it's a little harder.
It is harder.
A yacht harder. Or something. But for girls, it does. I have a separate blog on Modern Tribe, and one of the blog posts about bat mitzvah gifts gets a lot of traffic, and you know, then it has some, you know, options you can get. I think people want something a little more spiritual as a bat mitzvah gift, not just, you know, money or a gift card to the mall. You know, it's nice to have something for this momentous occasion, having something kind of meaningful. So I think, you know, a Jewish jeweler is really well. We added some moderately priced items that are perfect for a 13-year-old as well, that have done really, really well with the bat mitzvah crowd.
That actually raises an interesting question that, you know, I hear what you're both saying as a mixture between, I'm running a business and I'm looking to stock the things that will sell, and I look around to see what's out there. And also, you know, I am trying to drive Jews to engage more with Judaism as much as I can. And yes. And I wonder how, so let's think about the bar mitzvah gifts, because I remember for my bar mitzvah, one of my mom's friends, who was quite a bit younger than my mom at the time, gave me a baseball. And he said, I know that you're going to get all this other stuff for your bar mitzvah, but what you really want is a baseball. So I'm going to give you a baseball. And that was true. I think I know that I struggle a lot with thinking about, you know, trying to figure out things to buy for bar mitzvahs. And I wonder, to the extent that the products aren't out there, right, that nobody's sort of done a deep enough design job to try to figure out what would actually register with boys for that age. You know, is that something that you kind of see as a mission for a store like Modern Tribe, or is that sort of beyond the scope of the mission? You know, because I'm just thinking about, like, who is going to do stuff like that?
You know, at the time when I started Modern Tribe, I was considerably younger, and I thought I could change the world, really. And I felt certainly that Modern Tribe was part of that. It was part of a movement. And through my entrepreneurial venture into Modern Tribe and with No Limit Texas Dreidel, I was able to connect with other Jewish social entrepreneurs. And in Atlanta, we really were able to do something. We created a program for Jewish social entrepreneurs here in Atlanta called Protege, which I led and I ran. And we've had some really successful projects that are still continuing, specifically Jewish Kids Groups, which is an independent Hebrew school here in Atlanta that's striving to grow and expand into other cities, our Atlanta Jewish Music Festival. I'm really proud to have been part of that movement. And Amy, I'd love to hear how you feel about that. Like, it's only been a year since or a little over a year, I guess, since I sold Modern Tribe and handed the baton over to you. But it does seem like politically and socially, things are very different now. And then I also want to say that my experience has always been that all these innovative products that you're going to find on Modern Tribe, like the Spinagogue, like the Minerki, like, you know, name dozens of other products that you'll find on Modern Tribe. These are made by people who are passionate about Judaism. That is their main goal. They're not doing it to make $1 million. if they are, they're not going to make $1 million. Sorry to tell you this. It's definitely driven by a passion of wanting to enhance the Jewish experience.
The social changes. I've gotten more emails lately than ever with people saying, you know, I've always been kind of a cultural Jew. I sort of celebrate the holidays, but lately it seems like I'm more proud than ever to be Jewish. I want people to know I'm Jewish. Can you suggest a Star of David necklace? I've never worn one, but I'm inspired to wear one now. I've gotten a lot of messages like that.
That's so interesting.
Isn't it? And people that want to wear a funny Jewish t-shirt. They're not trying to hide that they're Jewish. It's the opposite, really. They're now more than ever, they want to say, I'm Jewish. I want everyone to know it. I'm proud of it. And here I am.
That's so good to hear, because obviously with all the overt anti-Semitism that has cropped up over the last year in the United States, it's so great to hear that it's having the opposite effect. Instead of pushing people to hide, people are feeling like they want to display their Judaism. That's amazing. During the 2008 presidential campaign, we had Obamacas, and then we had a Republican version, a Republican Jewish yarmulke. That was interesting.
Yeah, people have asked for a few for those again.
Did they want it for Hillary and Trump?
Yeah.
Oh, really? What did you think?
Mostly I got requests for Trump ones, actually. And
yeah,
I said, I'm not making those.
I mean, I think that's one of the hard things about the Jewish community, serving the Jewish community today, is that you definitely have, just like in American society, you have a greater divide in the Jewish community than before the Trump era.
But that's an interesting dimension. It's interesting to think about those of us who are involved in the nonprofit side of Judaism, and I know you are too in your own personal lives. Like, how do we look at what's happening on Modern Tribe or on What You Want to Eat and say, okay, and therefore we're learning that, hey, maybe our synagogues should be doing more of X, or maybe other organizations should be doing more of Y. And I'm wondering whether you think that there's a connection like that, or whether in some way you think that these dimensions, the sort of purchasing dimensions of Jewish life, are substantially different from the other kinds of Jewish living.
I think that the nonprofit world and the business world overlap in the idea of whether or not we should be pushing the envelope, in that it's important always to be differentiating yourself from whatever else is out there, right? I mean, that's what keeps people's interests. It keeps things exciting and engaging. And I know that nonprofits are also attempting to do that. I think they understand the importance of pushing the envelope and of taking some risk, being on the edge in order to keep people interested. I think where they get hung up can be in the large donor space and trying to not upset the large donor base, pretty much that's probably the nail on the head, if I'm being honest. It's not wanting to rock the boat or upset the more conservative, large donor base. And I think that it would be really great if the Jewish philanthropic space, and I know this is not about every Jewish philanthropist is this way, but I would hope that most Jewish philanthropists can understand that a certain amount of freedom and ability to make those decisions, to be a little bit edgy, forward-thinking, different, not the typical same old is important for this generation, probably for every generation. It has to be something new. It has to be something that fits, and that our ideas about Judaism and our connection to Judaism is changing. And I think that's okay.
Yeah, I think it's the nice thing about owning my companies here is I can you know, say what I want. And if I offend people, then it's kind of on me and no one, you know, my brother owns Modern Tribe with me, and we don't make that fact very known that we're a family owned company. We have my grandma suggests her favorite products for every holiday, that everyone loves that. She's really funny. So that does really well. But I think you also have a social obligation as someone with a platform, with people listening to you. So it's kind of hard to separate everything that's going on in the world with this business that you're trying to make money, and we're still human too, and have a reaction to things and stand your ground and not be afraid of how people are going to react.
So we are nearing the end of the episode, but before we go, are there any particular items on your website that you want to plug for listeners out there to consider getting their loved ones this Hanukkah?
So one I really love that's been doing well is called the Nash Menorah. It comes in brass, chrome, and they're coming out with rose gold. And it looks like kind of half of a bagel. It's modeled after half of a bagel, kind of a little horseshoe. And what I love about it too is the holders for the candles are kind of set in. So not during Hanukkah, you can still display it. And it's super beautiful just as a sculpture that kind of reminds you of Hanukkah or maybe reminds you of bagels. So I think that's something that is especially cool because it's art you can keep out all year long and not just take out once a year for Hanukkah.
Thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a great conversation and it was a pleasure having you on.
Thanks for having us.
So we want to close out this episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging all of you out there to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. Second, you can check out Facebook, just Judaism Unbound is our page. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. We also just got new email addresses, so you can hit us up at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. Very fancy. Last but not least, we always like to encourage folks to give us a financial donation if you're able, and you can do that either with a monthly recurring gift or a one-time donation at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.